Welcome to Feminist Question Time, brought to you by Women's Declaration International, the leading global organisation defending women's sex-based rights against the threats posed by gender identity ideology. There's more information on our website, womensdeclaration.com, where you will find our Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, which has been signed by 34,781 people from 160 countries and is supported by 492 organisations from all over the world. We have over 100 volunteer activists, including 53 country contacts engaged in women defending women's rights, and do join us as a volunteer. We're a women-only organisation. Today, I am really pleased to say we have Laura Favaro, or Favaro, who is from Spain in the UK, and the title of her talk is Academentia, Researching Gender Studies. She'll be speaking first, and then we are going to hear from Jen Kimmel from Ireland / USA, who's going to talk about her experiences as a trans widow and also with the ideology reaching her children in the captured locality and problems in feminist circles. We're going to then hear from me with a roundup of what WDI, Women's Declaration International, has been doing in relation to the United Nations and the United Nations NGO Forum, so those two international bodies. I'd like now to introduce our first speaker, who we're very lucky to have. We've got Laura Favaro. She's a feminist sociology with research and teaching experience in a number of universities, both in the UK and Spain. She's also a trained teacher. Previous to academia, she worked in compulsory education. The research she's going to present today was conducted at City University of London, and the title of the talk is Academentia, Researching Gender Studies. So thank you so much for coming, Laura, and over to you.
I'm here to talk about to introduce really some elements from what is quite a substantial piece of research that I have conducted over the past 3 years on what is sometimes called the gender wars in academia. And I have collected documents, social media, I have conducted interviews, a survey, and throughout the 3 years, I have been writing my own field notes as well as keeping a research diary. So there's a lot of data there. And so with apologies that today you'll be getting kind of the summary of the summary of the summary. In particular with regards to the bits in purple. And just to give you a little bit of a few kind of basic details about the interviews, I conducted these between October 2020 and December 2021. My participants were 50 academics who self-define as feminist and research and or teach on topics related to gender. They were primarily based in England and mainly senior lecturers and professors. Also, a quick note on terminology. So I'm going to be referring to the two orientations as regards to the dispute, as I have found them in my data. I'm not saying there's not, you know, other perspectives. As feminism versus genderism. And here I am, of course, aware that there are other terms in use, such as gender identity theory or gender identity movement. I myself, again, on the basis of my own analysis of my findings, I find genderism as particularly apt, not least because ultimately we are talking about a pro-gender movement. So now moving on to some findings from the interviews. I'm going to start with the feminist academics who had expressed, who when we spoke had already expressed their views publicly. And here, both individually and collectively, they gave me a long list of negative repercussions spanning from being ostracized by their community, academic community, no platforms, receiving complaints at work, all the way to, you know, abuse online, threats of violence, as well as physical aggression and intimidation, as we will be seeing later. Those feminist academics who had not decided to not voice their views publicly, they all alluded to the career stage. So those in the earlier stages of their career would claim that they didn't think they could survive the career, could survive the sort of backlash that they had seen those in their field faced, and they would note that those that tend to speak out, as they would say, were more senior. Then a mid-career scholar spoke about not being a professor, and a scholar in the later stages of her career spoke about wanting to finish her career and unscathed. But what we can find here is, you know, the common thread is fear, right? And very much also to do with, in particular, to do with the abuse towards feminists. Moving on to those participants, the participant group that positioned themselves as in the middle. And they talked to me about having almost kind of secret conversations. The participants spoke about a strange secret club of feminists with very few trusted colleagues. And they expressed feelings feeling depressed, anxious, concerned, alienated, and ultimately, as the scholar said, we are all so afraid, and that it doesn't feel like a safe space to speak up, and that is gender scholars, as this participant highlighted. They were scared of having to face significant negative consequences that they had seen, you know, they would note, you know, you see what happens to other people. They were afraid of being branded as transphobic, of being labeled a TERF or a gender critical feminist, and how that would then lead to becoming a target of attack. They would mention cases, you know, well-known cases of castigation and attacks of feminists. And also other things such as, you know, fears of losing their job and even putting their kids at risk. And again, this is academics. Right, so we are so afraid. It became quite clear that the main sources of, you know, the main reasons for their fears had to do with what this scholar defined as a particular sort of trans politics that has become so influential and which has cowed so many into submission. That was generally speaking, and in particular to do with violence, but also there were, with regards to academia in general, this understanding that genderism was hegemonic and that had actual material effects on people's careers. And as the sociologist put it, how maintaining that hegemony involves gatekeeping that then gets enforced in extremely violent ways. So in order to, you know, as a preservation strategy, as they, some participants themselves put it, they had opted to not engage with the debate, not even in a scholarly way. You can see this quote by a mid-career sociologist who said to me, yeah, there are things I could write. But I'm not going to write about it. I'm too scared. Others had even pulled back from gender studies altogether. So with regards to the research, this participant was considering it. Another participant was thinking about, you know, stopping her gender-related course as regards to teaching. And here we have also a quote by a participant who had a step down from her role as editor, as co-editor at a relevant journal, partly because of this, noting that she did not want to be associated with scholarship that is thought police. And again, common thread, scared, doesn't feel safe, I don't feel safe. In addition then to self-censoring, what also results from these self-preservation strategies is, you know, a contribution to the silencing of feminism in academia generally. So, for example, we have two quotes here where this late career sociologist says that, you know, she wouldn't invite a GC or a feminist speaker because she's been cowed by the violence. And there's this other late career academic who, you know, talks about talking students out of doing a very gender critical feminist project to kind of protect herself. And so another self-preservation strategy that that those participants that positioned themselves as in the middle spoke about relates to acceding to the commands of the doctrine, right? So we have a quote here by a mid-career scholar in feminist cultural studies, where she's saying, you know, talking about use in the language that now we all have to add, you know, or are expected to add, cis-normative, non-binary people. And she also mentioned the pronouns at the end of the emails. She was very critical of the practice, but she said, you know, it has crossed my mind just to do it to protect myself. Now, moving on to the third group of participants. So the genderist academics justified the silencing of feminists in academia through a range of discourses. One of them had to do with academic merit. So this idea that feminist scholarship is of poor quality, that it has now been delegitimized, it's outdated, it's out of touch. And yeah, we have a series of examples from the data. There's also a discourse of feminism as violence. So here, feminist views are presented as amounting to hate speech and as what was variously described as rhetorical, symbolic, or epistemic violence against people who identify as transgender. Moreover, I was told that the rhetorical violence actually does have real-world aims and that it supports real-world violence. As such, when we were discussing the decision by her academic organization to exclude GC feminists, this participant said, it's different to say we're silencing somebody versus we're actually causing harm towards somebody, which is what feminism is considered to do. In line with that discourse is are the comparisons of feminists with white supremacists, with fascists, with those on the far right, or those with homophobic or misogynistic views. And this was as part of, you know, how genderists would defend the no debate approach, tactic, and the no platforming of feminists in academia and beyond. So for instance, you can see this quote here by a mid-career scholar in the social sciences saying, you know, could we have a debate about whether Hitler was right? I see it as a similar thing.
We're going to go on to our second speaker, who's Jen Kimmel now. And Jen is from Ireland and USA. And she's going to chat with me or sort of tell us and share with us about her experience as a trans widow, also experiences with seeking help after the being a trans widow, then the ideology reaching her children, Jen, your children, and the captured locality and problems within feminist circles after speaking out. So there's so much. It didn't just stop there with being a trans widow, like the ongoing problems. But thank you so much for being with us, Jen. And so, what are your experiences? Maybe starting off about the trans widow bit of it.
So I met my ex-husband in 1995. I was 25 years old and he was 36. And I was working full time and studying full time. I was really stressed out, really, really busy. And he was really chill and super relaxing. And he would take me on camping trips and road trips. We would go to music festivals and he really became very close. I had a great time with him. I had the relaxing time I needed at the time. Now looking back, I realized maybe that was the first time I let my guard down. He made himself useful. And I So I knew him for maybe a few months, and he came into a room in his woman's gear, is what he called it. And I was surprised. And then he explained to me about the fact that when he was a child, about 6 years old, he came from quite a troubled home and he ran away. And he came upon his auntie's washing line and took her clothes off the washing line and put them on and fell asleep and was found later by his grandparents. So he said that he, since that time, used women's clothing as a comfort thing. When he would get depressed or stressed out, he would use dressing up like that as a way to comfort himself. He didn't tell me at the time that it was a fetish or indicate that it was a fetish. He tried to put it into a childhood story, which is common. We know that this is common now with men like this. And if they evoke a child, then a woman will be sympathetic, you know. So it would come back. I was never comfortable with it, to be honest. I just didn't like it. But at the time, you know, that first day, I told him how I had experienced sexual abuse as a kid myself, that I was bisexual. And the bisexual thing came back again and again, because to him, that meant that I was a playground, you know, that I had no real right to reject anything simply because I was attracted to men and women. And it just came back over and over again. But this is part of the thing. They will attack they will use your sexuality. They will attack your sexuality to control you. This is a common thing I've learned since. At the time, I didn't have all these words for it. But he would stop and pull away from this when I told him that I was uncomfortable. And all throughout our younger time together, I thought I was getting through to him. He would converse with me. I would tell him why it was problematic, why I didn't like if he wanted to dress as a woman when we had sex. He would listen and he would back off. And then it would start back up. And what I realize now is it often started back up when I was vulnerable. So when I was pregnant with my first child, for example, that's when he really started to go dressing a lot. He would take my clothes that no longer fit me and wear those. And I would tell him at the time that things he said hurt me and they were problematic. And I really thought we had a dialogue. So I would build myself and build my boundaries back up. And then I would slowly let them down again. And it became a cycle. And then this went on for, you know, I was with him altogether for about 15 years. So they talk about a frog in a pot, but it really was. It was just a slow boil and it was a cycle. But I do really want to say that these men, they will get you when they know that you have less ability to consent or when you're compromised. So when I had the kids, I had to choose between protecting them and protecting myself. You know, and that's very often the case with trans widows. In our experiences, the men do kick off when it's the most difficult for us to defend ourselves or to even focus on anything else but our kids.
One of the facts that I read recently, I guess many of us did, is that if a woman becomes ill, gets a sort of life-threatening disease or something, then that's a time very, very often a male partner will leave. So it's like you're really vulnerable and then they leave you. But the same similar thing, like you're saying, with kids, when you need the most support, you're doing so much work. That was when he sort of ramped up, saw it as an opportunity to be more abusive.
And I think they look for these times. You know, these men are networked. They do speak with each other, and we are who these men experiment on behind closed doors. I think when I was at my most vulnerable was when, obviously, when I moved to Ireland with him. He had told me that a lot of his depression came from being homesick. And I managed to convince myself that we would be able to be more of a family when we moved over here, you know, because it was pretty much me looking after the kids and him doing his thing. But when we got here, I'm not sure to this day if he set it up. that way. If he planned it for 10 years, I don't know. Possibly. But when we moved here, he was pretty much retired. And that's when the porn was constant. It was hours and hours that he spent online looking at porn. And then that's all he would think about. And that's just all he wanted to do. You know, he did never speak to me in a normal voice. He would always try to speak to me in the feminine voice. You know, I'd kept it away from the kids until that point. When it started that I couldn't, you know, that it was out of the bedroom, that's when it became very alarming, and that's when I became desperate, and I knew I had to get the kids out of there. You know, he would come in his dressed in his lingerie or whatever, but with a dressing gown over it, and come and sit in the sitting room with the kids, and I thought, I have to get out of here. I was absolutely desperate. It was a bad time. So that brings me to, I was able to get away then, when I made one friend. I was able to get out of the house one time for my birthday because his friends pressured him into recognizing it. And I met someone from the town, and she then came to visit, which he did not like, of course. And it was just that one woman, you know, gave me the strength. And of course, he was calling her a feminist and a lesbian. And, you know, any woman that would say no to men like this, they hate. So he was calling her all kinds of names. But I did get out with the help of her and a domestic violence service. And I have to say they did not know how to deal with my specific situation, but they relied on a coercive control model. And that's very much what it is with these guys a lot of the time. So, but when I first got away, it was very hard for me to find therapy, and I needed it because I had PTSD. There was a lot of sexual abuse and I was not in good shape. But I could not find a therapist that did not want to focus on him and his journey. And the therapist seemed to be very uncomfortable with what I was trying to get help about. And domestic violence groups I joined, I was actually removed from one for being transphobic because I explained that my ex, I relied, while I was still with him, I relied very much on a women's aid hotline in Ireland, and it was incredibly helpful. Since then, women's aid has really been captured. The chair of women's aid called for women like me, well, any woman countering any of this, but women like me to have our political and legal representation removed. So rape crisis. I rang rape crisis because I do occasionally get PTSD when it gets overwhelming. If I get threats through my front door now because I put my face out there. And when I rang them one time and I was in bad shape, I was told when I mentioned that my ex was trans-identifying, I was stopped and told I needed to remember that all genders rape and abuse. This kind of thing is a priority for a rape crisis line in Ireland now. And when I got out, community groups were essential for me. So there's a local community group that reaches out to vulnerable parts of the community and has a wee charity shop. I volunteered in that charity shop several days a week. I was able to meet locals and really get my roots down here and meet people. That organization has hired a trans rights activist to run it. So this man and his friend, when I had first spoken out, they found out that I supported J.K. Rowling and they wanted to lecture me about that. And I tried to tell them, well, this is really a complicated matter and I had a really bad experience and it's very personal to me, and they weren't having it. They lambasted me. And then one showed up at my house with a book called Whipping Girl by a man called Serrano, which basically says, if you want to be gang raped and abused, you must be a woman. This is what they brought to my house. These guys are now, they run a week-long festival in my remote locality. It's translated into Pride in the Irish speaking, Pride in the Irish language. So I'm in a very remote place and there's a week-long festival started by these two men in pretty much to counter whatever conversation I've started in my area. And my entire people don't have, they have no idea what's really behind this. especially since COVID happened last year. They were so happy to have any kind of liveliness in the town. Everybody was out happy to celebrate Pride, happy to show that they weren't homophobic. And it's got into me because I see the people in my town being used because they really have no idea what they're really backing, you know, because they were carrying that. It was not the Pride flag, it's the Pride, I think it's called a progress flag, you know, where it has trans and intersex. Mm. These humongous flags like this were my entire town, every business in the town was covered in these flags.
This is just amazing, isn't it? It's a small little town in Ireland.
Really remote, yeah. And they're going to, and it's starting again this year, and they are going to get funding. It's going to be big because they're taking, it's something called Uterus. It's because it's in the Irish language, you know, because Ireland, we want stuff to start happening again. So everybody was so happy to go to the, you know, to have the crack. They just had no idea. Meanwhile, I know that there's at least two girls in my town who are starting to desist. And how, you know, if you pull away from this, you're a traitor. The pressure that's on these young girls, and now it's going to be the flags are going to be everywhere. How much more difficult is it going to be for these girls and their parents?
And when you say desist, is that to not believe in it, in the genderism?
One stopped wearing a binder, which we know is very
bad. Oh, so they were sort of thinking that they were boys, or so detransitioning or desisting. Wow, yeah, and they're going to get in trouble, you think, then?
I just think it's going to be more difficult for them. You know, their parents are petrified to speak about it at all because we know that the young people are taught that you don't discuss this. And this was part of the reason why I don't know that I ever would have put myself out there if I didn't see all three of my kids being captured, even though I got away years later, utterly captured. The thing was, the main thing was, you do not talk about this at all. So then, you know, my kids began to see me as the enemy. Very embarrassing. You know, my youngest was frightened. He was afraid that someone was going to hurt us because I dared speak about these issues. It's to this day, it's the same, you know.
So was that it? This was in school and in the local community, sort of like youth groups and stuff.
It's just, well, my kids are homeschooled. Even though I did my best to kind of teach them about boundaries and consent, but they're still, and I live in this remote place, they still got them. They're in the arts, and the arts are utterly captured, you know, so everybody in their theater group will identify as non-binary or some kind of trans or demi something or poly, even though, you know, the youngest guys have never even dated anyone, but they think they're in a poly relationship. Basically, they just have a lot of really interesting friends, but they, you know, they're using this language and they don't even know what it is, you know, and they're talking, you know, 14-year-olds are talking about who's the top and who's the bottom, but what they really mean is who's outspoken and who's rather meek, you know. It's everywhere, and you can't. And if I tried to talk to a basic townsperson about what's going on and why this festival that's happening is an issue, I would look crazy, because there's just so many things about it. I would not even know where to start.
Yeah, I mean, it's making me think a bit that in Ireland, with the decline of the Catholic Church, and that, you know, there's sort of, people don't like the church anymore because of all the paedophile scandals, and they just don't like it. It sounds like they've all just, the whole community have just all gone on to this new religion.
Yeah,
thing.
That's what they say, you know. I mean, there's a bit of overcorrection going on, you know, when people, like us in my town, people do not want to be homophobic. They want to move along. They want to be show progress, but they're being duped. I hate it. They don't know what these two men that started this festival are really about. If I tried to explain it to them, they would pull away, because people don't necessarily want to know about an individual's woman's experience with this.
And this I was going to ask that too, because you've actually had experience, and you would think that some of these people you've had contact with would say, that's really interesting, we want to find out more, what is your experience? But nobody really did that.
Yeah, it would be really difficult, though, to bring, and that's part of the reason I was so stuck with them in the beginning. It's a difficult thing to talk about. There's a lot of sexual abuse with it. It makes people uncomfortable if you talk about my specific experience, and that goes back to trans widows. You know, so many people are talking about women's spaces and protecting women's spaces, but then if an individual woman tries to tell what happened, it does tend to put people off. I think people want to keep women want to keep a certain amount of distance from it. So they think that could never happen to me. And they don't want to hear about it. It's like dirty laundry. But it's essential, I think, that we hear individual women's experiences, because these men, as I said, they, you know, a woman's space is also our home. And I make a joke, you know, the call is coming from inside the house. It's from some horror movie. I don't know which one. I keep seeing memes about it, but it's already in our homes. This porn is in our home 24 hours a day. And these men, they do, you know, they're trying to dismantle boundaries, and they're trying to take apart what it is to be a woman. Well, they'll practice on an individual woman. And these men, when you're in a relationship with them, they take you down to pieces. They wait yeah. until you're vulnerable, and they attack your sexuality, which everyone knows from like the Catholic Church. If they can control your sexuality, they can control you. So they just take you down to pieces, and then they try to cobble some of those pieces to themselves and say that they were always theirs. And then they'll try to dispose of the rest. I mean, they just really want to plow over women, and they practice on their partners. It's a bit of a microcosm, you know, to what's happening in the wider world. And that's why I think our stories are important to hear, because we can play Yolan. There's a new focus now where they say, well, this is a feminist issue. It's separate from what's happening to the kids. First, we have to focus on these kids and take care of these kids. And the feminist thing is it, the feminists can do their thing, but we're going to help the kids. You can't separate it. It's all connected. You know, if you're going to attack women and you're going to harm women, you're going to harm the kids, because we take care of the kids. By and large, we're the ones looking after the kids.
Yeah. You know, so can you explain that? Who's saying this about it? We should take, are they just saying, oh, well, we don't mind the stuff about women, but we just don't want any harm done to kids? Is that what you're saying?
I think when people try to separate the two things, I think a problem starts there. I think it's all the one issue.
Yeah.
And there are people saying, look, you know, that's a feminist, the thing that's happening to women, it's a feminist issue. But the emergency, the crisis is with the kids, and there is certainly a crisis with kids, but it's all connected.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
You know, they're using kids as shields. But if we address what's happening with women, the kids will be protected. It's all together. If you divide it in that way, it's not the way to go, because mothers are being devalued. You know, kids aren't listening to their mothers. Their mothers are, you know, mothers like me, I'm the enemy now.
Yeah. You know, my kids, and how's that gone with your kids? So how do you manage to talk to them now?
I have to be, you know, I have to walk on eggshells. But, you know, I have to persevere. They will get it one day. I'm really happy that even though they sort of see me as the enemy, or they're sick of it, or they don't get it, they have great boundaries themselves. I raised them. And so I don't worry about my own that much. My oldest is still rather captured, but I have faith he will eventually come around. But, you know, when I hear them talking to their friends, they might buy into all this language, but they know very much about consent. They will not stand for violations. So it's difficult that my kids don't really have much respect for what I'm doing, but you know.
Yeah. You also mentioned about feminist circles, that you've had problems in feminist circles.
I haven't had problems in feminist circles as such, but I think the problem is just that separation where, you know, this is a feminist issue and taking care of the kids is something else, and, you know, it's a priority, and separating that, I just think it's the all.
Yeah.
The same thing. It's a whole.
Yeah. And what about organizations? Are there organizations that you're in touch with or in Ireland that are growing up trans widows?
Not for trans widows. No, there's not a lot being done. You know, all the violence against women and girls organizations are thoroughly captured. And I don't see much happening about that, but I'm not in touch with everyone all the time. I have to back away a lot of the time because it gets overwhelming. Because I am dealing with it right at my front door now with these festival goers. You know, we had a thing years ago, it was called the Friday Pint, and the middle-aged women would get together on a Friday and have a pint. And I've just learned that they're not so sure about inviting me now because I'm known as anti-gay. I've been openly bisexual since I've been an adult. It has absolutely nothing to do with being anti-gay.
Completely
this is what that festival has done, you know, because I can't really defend myself without looking like a loony to people. people. It's also complicated. So it's all boiled down to Jenny's anti-gay because she has a problem with this, which is, it's really the furthest thing.
Yeah. And I suppose it doesn't really matter if to them that it's not true, because if they feel that they're being loyal to the new dogma,
they don't want to take the risk either way.
And then you're the outcast and they can prove their loyalty by ostracizing you.
Yeah. And there are some people who heard what I had, you know, women who've heard what I had to say, and I told them who was behind this festival, but at the end of the day, they couldn't really, they didn't want to miss the party. And so, you know, they all joined in, and I felt very isolated. I didn't have anybody that would have a partner, and he's great, and he's a rock, and he's right behind me, but I didn't have much, everybody else just wanted to join in the party. They didn't really matter much to the one woman said to me, well, just go to the party and don't let them win. But it's just counter to everything I stand for. Another thing I want to mention, that's the girls that are just the thing, is Munchausen. You know, there are people that I know are not quite right and are using their kids to be part of this. I know there's one woman in my town who's absolutely has, I don't know how to pronounce the word, Munchausen, I think, by proxy.
I think so, yeah.
Last year, I saw that she was involved in the festival, and I thought, oh no, her youngest. And sure enough, her youngest now is identifying as trans. Just since last year when this festival happened. It's just such a dangerous thing, and I wish I could somehow explain this to the people who are so gung-ho about it, but it's just impossible. It's just so hard to watch when I feel powerless about it. But then I was saying there's a lot happening in Ireland. There's a group called The Countess. There's a group called the Irish Women's Lobby. There's Women's Space Ireland. There's individual women. There are a lot of women involved in fighting back against this. I'm not hopeless.
We're going to go on to the next speaker, which, strangely enough, well, not strangely, but just the reality is it's me. I'm going to do the next talk. And what I'm going to talk about is the United Nations NGO event. It's about the United Nations and also the what happens. There's an NGO forum around the United Nations that is meant to get the views of women all over the world. And I'm going to tell you about what WDI has been doing in relation to that and what we've found out. So much of this is done by people, not me, in WDI. And I'm just sort of sharing with you what women have done. So brief introduction to the UN. They have done quite a lot. The United Nations they were founded in 1945. Currently, there are 193 member states. So it's the closest thing in a way that we have to a global parliament. How much power they have is very up for sort of debate. It's probably not very much power, but they are a place where the countries, the states of the world can meet and discuss things and interact and hopefully solve things peacefully. Human rights have been around. The idea of human rights have been a long time. This is the idea from the French Revolution that all human beings are born equal in dignity. This is actually from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that they should act in dignity. And people are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. So that's a bit of a worry, isn't it? It says brotherhood. But so the French Revolution was big on rights, and the Enlightenment, those sort of 17th, 18th century, 19th century, the idea that people were equal, but it was men and it was the fraternity, the brothers. There were early advocates of women's rights, Olympe de Gouges and Mary Wollstonecraft and suffragettes. Then get up to 1945, and Eleanor Roosevelt was put in charge of and took charge of bringing together and drafting with others the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And So that was a sort of important document, one of the founding documents of the United Nations. Then almost immediately after that, the Economic and Social Committee of the UN adopted a resolution implementing the principle of equal pay for work of equal value for men and women everywhere. So that's very much the women as workers should be treated equally, but it didn't go much further than that. And in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it was basically the state should treat men equally, but men could do what they wanted in the family. So women were in trouble because, you know, it was fine to rape us, give us no money, etc. So it was a sort of no man's land or a violent area, the family, and men were allowed to do what they wanted. Anyway, later on, we got, via the United Nations, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. That's CEDAW, and you hear that a lot in relation to the United Nations. And these countries, the dark blue ones, have all ratified, so they've signed and ratified and implemented, to some extent, CEDAW. So United States is a signatory, but has not ratified it. And then you can see a couple of countries have not, like Sudan and I think it's Iran and Somalia have done no action, but most countries have. Now, here's a picture of the United Nations. This is their General Assembly in New York. It's a very significant place where people of the world come together to discuss global problems. And so women have, since it was founded, have seen this as a place that we want to lobby, we want to make our voices known, and we want to gain ground for women's rights. Now, it, as well as the formal United Nations, there are two areas where civil society, NGOs, that's non-governmental organizations, can join in. One of them, so you could be, if you were the representative to the United Nations for your country, that's one way, or we could lobby our UN representative. But you can also get ECOSOC status, so you can get recognized, and then you can speak at United Nations events. And the Commission on the Status of Women happens every March for 2 weeks. But there are many times when women's issues are discussed. Now, to get ECOSOC status, you have to have various bits of standing as an organization. And currently, WDI does not have ECOSOC status, but COAL, the Coalition of Activist Lesbians in Australia, who are one of our signatory organisations and we work closely with, has got ECOSOC status. And I imagine maybe some of you know in organisations that have that. So you have a voice at the UN. But the other place you can have a voice at the UN is this parallel event. And you can see women here in meetings who come along to this. Is like a side event outside the United Nations, so any NGO can turn up and make their voices heard. So it's a way of sort of getting voices from all over the world who aren't necessarily properly organized, not long term, but have organized as women, in this case because it's to do with women. So theoretically this should be a place where our voices will be heard. Now, they've done really good things. You sort of probably hear about that. The International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, the 25th of November. So this is a UN promoted day. And just to show that the UN's important and the fact that countries, states have ratified CEDAW and take notice of the international community and the UN, is the abortion changes in Northern Ireland. This was recently changed, 2020. Now, if you go into the House of Commons Library, that's the British House of Commons, it states that one of the reasons they allowed abortion in Northern Ireland, and it says on this slide, was they want to go along with the recommendations in paragraphs 85 and 86 of the CEDAW report, and the CEDAW report on the United Kingdom suggested that that would help. Now, States don't want to look really bad compared to other states, and they often do take advice from the United Nations or United Nations bodies and reports that come out. And they also have actually ratified CEDAW. So anyway, here's a government saying that the reason they did something, which in this case is good for women, allowing abortion, is because of the UN. Now, this is another good thing that they do. UN women have quite a lot of money to promote actions on behalf of women. So this is a woman teaching girls how to write and read, promote education. And then this is another situation where a young Nigerian woman is helping to set up initiatives to get women involved in communities after the Boko Haram abduction of the girls from a girls' school in northern Nigeria, and to just, but to empower women in northern Nigeria and those sort of areas. So that's another excellent action from UN women. Now, but there are conflicts of rights, and there's a massive conflict of rights, which you can imagine what that's going to be. So, or you probably, a lot of people know that. So the UN executive director, this is the former one, the one before the current one, said a couple of years ago, people have a right to identify themselves in the way that they want to. It is our role as feminists to always be there and to make sure that people know that we accept them for who they are. So about the last 4 or 5 years, UN Women, which is the body in charge of promoting women's rights globally and getting information from women globally, gathering our voices internationally to carry on the good work of the international community and international sisterhood, have decided that men who say that they're women are women. Now, we as WDI, we wrote, a few women, Sheila Jeffries, Maureen O'Hara, and Heather Brunskill-Evans, and a couple of others drafted, with some feedback from others, a Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights. And this is directly based upon the commitments made by states all over the world under CEDAW. And the reason being that this is existing commitments by governments all over the world to promote women's rights. And we were saying, you've started doing a good job, let's continue to promote CEDAW. There's so much more work to be doing to reduce violence against women, get rid of oppression, exploitation, etc. And you could see here that we had started off with various organizations, and now, right now, we've got, this is today, we've got 34,000, nearly 35,000 signatories and 492 organizations. So you would think that given that our declaration is basically promoting CEDAW, which the United Nations is a United Nations convention, and we have the support of nearly 500 organizations and nearly 35,000 people, you would think that the UN NGO body would give us a place to represent those views. Those views are very, very straightforward. They're basically saying women's, and these are our the parts of the declaration. Our rights are based on sex. Motherhood is a female status. We want physical and reproductive integrity, freedom of opinion and expression, and a couple of others. You can look on the website or pause this to see. Now, the problem that we, WDI, worry about is that replacing the word sex with gender identity in law, policy, and social practice undermines all, pretty much all of the progress made on behalf of women. And it's a very clearly sort of logical argument, which is about 6,500 words long, based on the commitments people have made and evidence, logical evidence. And now we've got lots of actual evidence since then. Now, what have we been doing since then? As an organization. So in June 2021. Now, we were called the Women's Human Rights Campaign at the time. You could see on this slide. We sent a letter to probably about 20 or 25 key decision makers in the United Nations institutions and bodies and governments, explaining our concern. And you can see here that 2021, we had 18,000 signatories, but we explained the argument about replacing the legal category of sex with gender identity, and that that would be a problem for women. We also made in six languages a PDF which explained the ideas of the declaration and explained why CEDAW is good, but why CEDAW will be undermined, why all these brilliant ideas for women's rights are going to be destroyed. We did not hear back from them. Now, July 2021, our Australian group, the Feminist Legal Clinic, that they are the representatives of WDI in Australia, they made a joint submission to the CSW. So that's the actual UN body. So you can lobby direct individuals who are decision makers, or you can lobby the actual sort of committees. And this is the Commission on the Status of Women. So we lobbied them, said our concerns. Then in 2022, for those 2 years, we participated in the NGO side event at the CSW. So that's a New York side event. In fact, the year before, we actually went along and launched our declaration in New York. Well, we being some of WDI, so Leila Namdarkin, Sheila Jeffries, Maureen O'Hara, Heather Brinskill-Evans, and a couple of other people, and went along. So we went along, launched the declaration, tried to get the message out. Now, we also followed up these CSW meetings with very specific concerns about the rolling out of this SOGI, this sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender-based language throughout UN-Women, which I think is a very Orwellian way of, they've changed their name to UN-Women, like in the, as a step towards our total erasure. But UN-Women have adopted this inclusive language, and we, you know, we lobbied them and said we're worried about it. And so we've given very, very detailed argumentation and backed it up and sent it to most of the key decision makers in countries. Now, we have 51 country contacts, and we have at various times got our country contacts to lobby their own UN representatives. So we are gradually getting the message out, and we don't hear a lot back from them, but we do believe that, well, we know we have some supporters in the UN system, and we know that some of the decision makers agree with us. Some of them are starting to raise concerns, and they are using the term sex-based rights, which, as far as I understand, was first used in our declaration on women's sex-based rights. And I was looking around Googling sex-based rights the other day, and it does look as if that I think probably Sheila Jeffries, who I understand developed the term, and we were talking about what's going to go in the declaration, and I remember a conversation with Sheila where she was saying, I think sex-based rights is the best term we can use. It's not perfect, but it will do. It's good. So Sheila's not here because she's away, but let's get that. We'll find that out. But that term of the Defence of Women's Sex-Based Rights does seem to have it percolated into some areas of the UN, and we do definitely think we have supporters at a range of different levels. So this sort of relentless lobbying and very effective lobbying and raising awareness and building a grassroots movement has is going to pay off. We are going to win this, we think. And this is, it explains a bit what WDI's strategy is, what we've been doing on that. Okay, so this is just the PDFs that we sent when we sent around to all these recently, to all these decision makers. And you could see it's really impressive. It's very well written, formal response to the UNCSW communication, letter of complaint from Australia, information from Brazil, from Mexico. Sometimes we've done this in five languages. Now, 2022, following the, the CSW this year has just finished. It just finished yesterday. So we didn't get to have to do anything at the NGO forum because they wouldn't let us this year. But just say that last year we did get to do a presentation, and we got quite a lot of women and men came along to hear our concerns in this huge international online and offline meeting that gathers women from all over the world. So we were sharing our information. Now, this was the follow-up, which was done, and we're asking for UN Women's response, but they never responded. Now, not only that, but this year, and I actually think apologies if I haven't put everything in, because I think there's been other actions that I'm maybe not sharing. But this year, there were two actions towards UN bodies. One of them, the OHCHR, which is something on human rights. Sorry, maybe someone in the chat will know what it stands for, but the organization of something on human rights. And then the CEDAW committee. Now, it's a very obscure organization, the UN, with many different bodies, and they meet in Geneva sometimes and in New York and in various other places, and they intersect as this sort of web of global governance, which does try to do positive things sometimes in relation to women's rights. So we're carrying on sending submissions wherever possible, and WDI, being a really large organization now with lots of activists, is our strategy is to keep going, to keep raising awareness and use the declaration and use the fact that we've got nearly 500 organizations supporting us and that we've got 37,000 signatories to say this is valid. There's, you know, people of the world are worried about this change in language. Here's something from UN Women on International Women's Day. This is a couple of years ago. They are really promoting genderism, that the ideas of genderism, and that the idea that men who say they're women are women, and then putting out these bits of sort of false narrative. Trans women are 4 times more likely to experience violence than cisgendered people. So they're using the words, they use their platform and the money that our governments give to the United Nations to promote this ideology. There's this year they had an NGO forum, and I'll just show you a couple of bits which are really quite worrying from this NGO forum. So these are the safety guidelines, and at the bottom of the first block it says, this is what they're saying we should be doing if we go along to their NGO forum. It says, honor confidentiality and I statements. I, instead of they, we, or you, speak from your own experience instead of generalizing. So complete individualism. So there, we're now being encouraged, or maybe told, this is safety guidelines, that we should not say women are annoyed about male violence. That would be generalizing. What they want us to do is become utterly fragmented individuals who cannot be a political movement. And then also, I mean, you can see here, it says, respect the diversity of languages, opinions and expertise, while acknowledging that sexism, racism, classism, heterosexism, transphobia, Global North domination and other institutionalized forms of oppression exist. So transphobia is the big one that they're taking on board now, which is the reason that we were not allowed, WDI were not allowed to have a side event this year. Well, at least we assume that, because of course they don't tell us exactly why. This is what their event was this year. It was about innovation and digital technology for gender equality. So they do use the word women and children. They carry on using it, but they use it interchangeably with gender. And so sex and gender are the same thing in their mind. They've forgotten the idea that gender is a form of oppression, and it promotes sex role stereotypes, and it's a way of oppressing women. They did know that about 15 years ago, but that's gone by, and now it's all gender equality, gender-based violence, so we don't see who's doing what to whom. This is their response to us, saying your application to host a parallel event this year has been denied, as your event does not align with NGO CSW stroke NY, that's New York's, values or mandate. And that's a sort of typical act where they don't say we don't like you because we think you're transphobic, or because this is hate speech. It's we can't really say why, but we do know that what we are wanted to do is host a parallel event to say that we have these webinars and we're promoting CEDAW using technology, because it's meant to be about technology. So we're basically saying we want to show how well we are promoting women's rights and trying to fight oppression. And they say that doesn't align with their values. But typically they're a bit obscure about it. And then just to show one of our final things is that we followed up to say we would like to have a meeting, we'd like to discuss our concerns. And so that's being done by WDI. And that gives you a quick overview of what we've been doing. So it's quite a core part of our work. We don't believe that the UN is at all perfect. And we know that they have not, they've done imperfect things in the past. But we also sort of value CEDAW, and we value the Beijing Platform for Action. And we also value the international, the sort of feeling of international sisterhood that came from those massive UN conferences. And we hope that by engaging with them, we can influence the debate. And we do hear back from some of our sort of WDI members that it is being heard within the United Nations. So that's it. That's what we're doing.